Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. America turns the page. A US bishop comments on Barack Obama's historic victory in the nation's presidential elections and what this will mean for America and the wider international community. High stakes. With more and more people becoming addicted to gambling, we look at church warnings about how this apparently harmless pastime can easily become a dangerous compulsion. And Paul and the Resurrection. At his weekly general audience, Pope Benedict talks about St. Paul's teaching on the resurrection of Christ. In the US, Democrat Barack Obama has made history by scoring a clear victory over his Republican opponent John McCain to become America's first black president. Aged 47 and the son of a Kenyan father and a white mother from Kansas, Obama will be sworn in as the nation's 44th president on January the 20th. In his victory speech, Obama said he would work to ease the country's sharp political divisions and listen to those who voted against him. Reactions to Obama's groundbreaking victory have come from leaders around the globe. The Vatican said on Wednesday that it hoped the US president-elect will work to promote peace and justice in the world. Spokesman Father Federico Lombardi said all of us are hoping that Obama will be able to meet the expectations and hopes directed at him, that he will work for the cause of rights and justice, find suitable ways to promote peace in the world, foster people's development and dignity while respecting human and spiritual values. The faithful are praying, he added, so that God may enlighten him and give him a hand in his huge responsibility, so that he will govern well. But let's cross back to the United States itself to get some feedback to the election's outcome. Many commentators are describing Obama's victory as a new dawn or a turning point in that nation's history. So what's the reaction of the Catholic Church there? And what will Obama's historic win mean for the US and the wider international community? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Bishop William Murphy of Rockville Center, New York, who heads the Church's Committee on Justice, Peace, and Human Development.
Well, it's very clear that for the whole nation, this is an historic moment, and that's reflected in the remarks that everyone has made. It certainly brings to a close in a public and very important way the whole long history of racism on official levels in this country. There does, however, remain another issue, which is it remains to be seen how this will affect those groups of Afro-Americans who continue to be in difficult circumstances, and that raises the issue of poverty. So we continue to have the specter of poverty in certain parts of our country, and that disproportionately affects Afro-Americans. But we cannot take away from the fact that this is an historic moment in the history of our nation.
Obama's victory in these elections has been, by a very large majority of the rest of the world, been welcomed. What do you think are President-elect Obama's greatest strengths, the strengths that helped to propel him to this historic victory?
My sense is that, first and foremost, he's a very intelligent man. We've met only once, but we had a good conversation. He's a very attractive candidate. He's very well-spoken. He has the ability to move a group with his vision. He has a kind of personality that reassures people beyond the particular issue. And that gives him a certain advantage, I believe. And I do believe that, quite frankly, in many ways, this nation is tired and wants a fresh voice and a fresh face. And I think he represented very much that.
So what does Obama's victory mean for the U.S. and also for the wider international community, in your view?
It strikes me that it means a new direction, obviously, both domestically and on the international front. It means an end to the Bush administration, which had become an unpopular administration, both at home and abroad. It remains to be seen how this new president will be able to harness the energies of people into a policy that will unite the country domestically and which will set a tone and a direction for international discussions and international questions.
Now, of course, the greatest challenge facing the new president-elect is the global financial crisis. What message would the church give to President-elect Obama on this issue?
Well, I think that, first of all, this is one of the most pressing, and it is the one that right now garners our attention. I don't think that we need or we should be measuring the most important issues by what the media announces to be today's problem. I would say that, obviously, he's going to have to address these issues of the economy. I believe, frankly, that the administration, the current administration, has addressed them in a way that has had a real coherence to it. And I believe that it's doing so in a way that should move us beyond the lack of confidence that Wall Street speculators have been showing. I think Mr. Obama is going to have to reassure the public by the kinds of persons whom he chooses to be around him, because I don't think anyone would say that he has a full-fledged economic plan. And that's going to be something that the church will be watching very, very closely. One of the things we as church would be saying in this issue, as in a number of other issues, which quite frankly are as important or even more important, is how will Mr. Obama be a uniter of our society and a unifying voice for the good not only of this nation, but also of the international community of nations.
Right, we focused there on the global financial crisis, but as you rightly said, there are many other urgent priorities, particularly as far as the church sees things. Would you list some of these other ones that you really would like Obama to tackle?
I'd be very happy to. I think that we have a major challenge in this country, which has to do with, to use the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have proclaimed as a kind of cornerstone of the United States that everyone is created equal. And yet, we have systematically and through our courts and through other means, systematically excluded a whole portion of our citizenry from sharing in that, and I'm speaking, of course, of the horror of 40 to 50 million aborted babies. This is a tremendously dark stain on the American nation and contradicts what we claim to be a people for whom liberty, justice, and the pursuit of happiness, which means founded on life, is given to everyone. When we exclude the unborn babies through abortion, then we are not living up to what we claim to be. Unfortunately, Mr. Obama has made it very clear that his record is very, very, not pro-choice, but pro-abortion. We as bishops will be urging him to rethink this. We will be urging him not to ignite further cultural and divisions and dividing the country further on this most important issue. So I think we're going to urge him to rethink those positions and to try to reflect the widespread feeling that abortion on demand is not a good thing in itself because it kills children, and that it's not a good thing for our country because it cuts at the very core of a good society.
During the campaign, the bishops issued their document, Faithful Citizenship, addressed to the faithful. Do you think the messages that were contained within it did get across to Catholic voters? And what feedback did the church receive to this document?
You know, that's a very good question. And I thank you for asking it because it's something that I've wrestled with during the whole campaign. We worked very hard on that document, and I believe that it was a significant step forward in the statements that the United States bishops have made before each of the presidential elections going back to 1976. Because we turned our focus on that, those first words, the importance that we have as teachers, the responsibility we have as teachers to form the consciences of Catholics. I believe that it had a very good and positive impact in many, many sectors of the Catholic Church. I think between 1.5 and 2 million copies of that document were distributed across the United States.
I was speaking to Bishop William Murphy of Rockville Center, New York. More people are gambling, largely due to the huge growth in online betting. But how high can the stakes really get? When does a game of roulette cease to be a harmless pastime and become a dangerous compulsion? Well, the answer is far more often than many people think. Figures suggest that a significant percentage of regular gamblers can gradually become addicted to gambling. And this in turn can lead to marriage breakups, domestic violence, child abuse, bankruptcy, and even suicide. I've been finding out more in this special report.
Make no mistake, gambling is an addiction. It can turn into an illness very quickly, and this is what the gambling companies play on.
John Farrelly is a counsellor at Accord, a Catholic marriage support service in Ireland. He has seen with his own eyes how more and more Irish families are coming under pressure due to gambling addictions. Despite the negative impact on families and individuals, the gambling industry is going from strength to strength. Figures show that the global revenue from gambling is growing by nearly 10% a year and is expected to top $100 billion in a couple of years' time. John says Ireland is no exception to this worldwide boom.
It is growing all the time. For example, I'm just thinking in terms of in Dublin at the moment, there's six casinos, which, you know, not too long ago there was no such thing as a casino. In terms of the online gambling, some of the most profitable companies in Ireland are makers who have now gone online. And I suppose the real hard thing about all this is it's hidden just below the surface. A lot of these companies are offshore companies, and so the profits don't necessarily come back through the Irish books. And so it's really hard to track how much is being spent. But just in terms of people coming to Accord, we know it's becoming an issue for marriage and family.
The Diocese of Calgary in Western Canada is thousands of kilometres away across the ocean from Ireland, but here too there is growing concern about the impact of compulsive gambling. Bishop Frederick Henry is the local bishop, and he has been at the forefront of efforts to speak out about the dangers of getting involved with gambling.
We're seeing more and more anecdotal evidence in particular of just the range of devastation of family life. People are losing their homes, they're losing their cars, they're losing their jobs. They get involved in all kind of nefarious activity in order to support a gambling habit. But as I say, I don't think we should just be looking at it from an individual pathology point of view, but we should be looking at it from a social or public health view. And it's this particular dimension that I think is new, and we're looking at this and starting to say now, what does this do to us as a society? Does the government, in order to avoid the unhealthy subject of taxation, resort to something that's regressive, that we know it doesn't depend upon personal income, but does tend to target those who are weak and vulnerable, frequently the poor and some of the seniors in our society?
John Farrelly explains how even a parent's concern for their children can be secondary to feeding their gambling addiction.
Well, let's put it this way. If you have children, they need to be fed and they need to have shoes on their feet at the very simplest level. When one's addicted to gambling, that can actually become secondary. The gambling can become the primary thing, the preoccupation with the gambling. And At its very worst level, it can mean that children, it can force children and family into poverty.
And roughly speaking, do we know what percentage of those who gamble do become addicted?
Well, this is the real problem with this area. How it came to us in Accord was we have training on a regular basis, and 5% of people coming to us have problems with addictions. However, we're beginning to notice, even before the stats are out, a number of our counsellors, we would have 300 counsellors, and those counsellors, it really is becoming a problem that they're talking about. And so what you probably find is that it's just below the radar, but is going to become a problem for society, and particularly Irish society.
I gather that the incidence of online gambling is increasing incredibly fast. Is that the case in Ireland as well?
Yeah, very much so. I suppose the thing is, it's marketed in a way that it's your best friend and it's a bit of fun. The marketing executives and the people who purport this don't sit in the counselling rooms with us.
Just as gambling is increasing in leaps and bounds in many countries, so are the number of compulsive gamblers, who can become so desperate that sometimes they are driven to take their own lives. John again.
I give you an example of a man and a woman that we were seeing. They were surviving, but they had a mortgage out in their house for €500,000. When you talk to them and it unravels, then you hear about this years and years of taking out another mortgage, and there was no need to. So in about 5 or 6 years, they owed 400 to 500,000. And if that was to continue for another 5 years, you can just imagine how bad that family would be. They were really under pressure. It was really putting their marriage under pressure. But for all the world, there wasn't a problem, but there really, really was.
And do we have any ideas how many families are coming under pressure because one or both of the spouses has a gambling addiction?
It's very hard to put a figure on it, again, because of the stigma around it and also the way the companies market it. But recently, there was an example in Scotland, and the chap spent over 158,000 one night by maxing out 13 credit cards belonging to his parents, and eventually then committed suicide. The real thing here is that there's no structures and processes to control this. What you have is the ability of people who are purely after profit. Really need to keep this in mind. Have no regard for the people, the individuals or the children involved. And the only thing driving this is the pursuit of profit.
The problem, according to John, is that addiction to gambling is a slow and insidious process that can creep up on its victims unaware.
The thing with an addiction is it slowly, slowly, slowly gets worse, and eventually you end up really in the ha'penny place, for want of a better word. Really what you need to do with any form of addiction is first recognise that the addiction's there and bringing the real facts of the amount of money that is spent. And really with addiction, it very quickly imprints itself on the relationship if you can get both people to be honest about it.
You talked about the fact that gambling is an industry based on profit. Do you think, in fact, that in some ways gambling panders to the worst in human nature, both on the part of the gambler who is looking for riches and, of course, the industry that's looking for profits?
I think so. However, I do believe that society is about the structures and processes we put in place for our people, because human beings are vulnerable at different times in their life. And really it's about the leaders in that community, the government, the church, trying to set, you know, what do we believe in? Obviously there's a free will there for people. However, when you have structures in place in terms of entities and companies, there is no good for society there whatsoever. There has to be some way of looking at this and trying to elicit, you know, what's going on here. But I take your point about it does tap into this idea of the get-rich-quick scheme, the fantasy in terms of gambling and addiction.
Bishop Henry says whilst the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that gambling is not intrinsically wrong, he believes it is morally wrong for a Catholic institution to formally cooperate in an industry that is based on greed.
The Catechism of the Catholic Church very clearly and succinctly expresses Catholic teaching and says that games of chance, whether we're talking about card games or modest wagers, are not in themselves contrary to justice. But they become morally unacceptable when they deprive someone of something that is necessary for their needs or those of others. So there is always something deep inside of us that seems to kind of open up this passion for gambling to become really enslavement, and we know that there are many victims. What has changed, I think, however, in our society is the development of the culture of gambling, where it's become not only part of entertainment, but now it's used by governments and others as a source of significant fundraising rather than by way of taxation. And we've changed the terminology from gambling to gaming to make it more palatable. And in the process, we have found that many Catholic institutions even have decided, well, we're going to go along with this because this is easy money for us, and we are now starting to look at the morality from the vantage point of a Catholic institution getting involved in the raising of money through an industry that is morally problematic insofar as it's based on greed and it takes advantage of the weak and the vulnerable in our society.
Bishop Henry has been spearheading a campaign to try to persuade Catholic schools to put an end to the use of casino and bingo fundraising ventures.
The major concerns that we have at this time are government-sponsored, what we call charity casinos, in which the individual schools or societies associated with the schools agree to provide workers who will assist in the actual holding of gambling events through the staffing of the venues and the running of the various games and so on. And this is wherein we have now a proliferation of this, and the individual schools, of course, receive a certain percentage or a certain cut from the revenues that come. So it looks like a win-win all around. The industry itself gets more support. The individual charity needs, whether it's a school or something else, can easily plug into this. And through the working of one or two nights, you can raise $60,000 or more. And one of the things that, of course, has happened is that we see an increasing dependence or reliance upon gambling because it's much easier than trying to raise money in other forms, such as bake sales or individual selling of individual products. But now I think we're moving into a situation where we're really gambling with our kids' futures, and we're setting a bad example for them, and this is now becoming a family policy issue and therefore a significant moral issue.
But how much money is being bet by gamblers? As Bishop Henry explains, it's often an eye-opener to learn just how much each household can spend on gambling.
When you look at an individual household, what it might mean in the life of a Canadian family, is it's interesting to see on a comparative basis where the expenditures are made. So what they have determined, and this is not my figures, but comes from the Vanier Institute of the Family, actual gambling expenditures right now in Canada per household is $1,080. And that is higher than the amount that is spent on education, which is $1,007, and on personal care, which is $834. And it's very close to $1,588 that's spent on health care. So when you just look at the money that is going out and into this particular industry, we have to ask the question, well, what does this redirection of money mean for a family? And I'm afraid that many times not only are certain essentials kind of being overlooked by reason of the promise of perhaps, but many individuals are being affected. And we're not only dealing with the problem gamblers, but we're finding now that we're cannibalizing our local economies. We're redirecting discretionary spending away from established businesses, traditional charities, alternate forms of entertainment, and contrary to basic needs and support of family life itself.
Gambling is a money spinner for those providing it, and many governments have been quick to capitalize on the revenue that can be generated by the gambling industry. But in Bishop Henry's view, the Canadian government and others should not be seduced by this desire to swell their coffers with the proceeds from gambling profits. And that message, he says, goes for the Catholic Church as well.
I think one of the things that our governments have to do is get out of gambling business. They cannot be the regulator and the promoter and the beneficiary at one and the same time. For the Catholics involved, I think we have to once again emphasize the harm that this is doing to people. And once we begin to kind of put a face and a name to some of the devastating consequences of this and not just regard people as statistics.
Bishop Henry says it's precisely this conflict of interest that is so dangerous.
The gambling industry, including the government, has to promote its product in order to maximize its revenues. And one of the things that they're constantly doing is trying to sanitize the fallout. So, for example, in Canada, it was reported that there were 22 suicides, or when you consider the whole industry in Canada that can be directly related to gambling. Well, you have a government that's involved in this, and the government is supposed to be protecting people, and yet at the same time, the government is promoting gambling. And what is an acceptable level of suicide? Is it 22? Is it 50? Is it 1? We're simply not being realistic in terms of understanding that what we are doing to families and people is we're turning them once again into objects. We're trying to recruit new players. We're broadening the base of charitable workers. We're generating more use among existing players. The whole thing is based on greed, and it's exploitive.
That was Bishop Henry of Calgary in Canada, and earlier you heard John Farrelly, a Catholic counsellor in Ireland. I'm Susie Hodges. St. Paul's teaching on the resurrection of Christ was the focus of Pope Benedict's catechesis at his Wednesday general audience. Emma McCarthy reports.
Christianity is not an easy path to follow, but a demanding climb illuminated by the light of Christ and his great hope. Continuing his series of lessons on St. Paul this Wednesday, Pope Benedict dedicated his audience to the saint's proclamation on Christ's resurrection.
In preaching Jesus Christ risen from the dead, Paul was concerned to hand down what he himself had received from the apostles. He proclaims not only the fact of the resurrection, but its vital significance in Christ, who died and rose for us. We have been saved, made righteous in the sight of God. The resurrection reveals Jesus' true identity as eternal Son of God and Lord of the living and the dead.
Pope Benedict underlined that the theology of the cross is not mere theory, but reality, the reality of every Christian.
We, for our part, are called to become fully configured to him in the mystery of his Passover from the death to life. Our present sufferings thus become a sharing in Christ's own suffering and death, while the hope of the resurrection even now draws us towards the fullness of life with all the saints in his kingdom. Salvation, Paul tells us, comes from confessing with our lips that Jesus is Lord, and believing in our hearts that God raised him from the dead. With the apostles then, let us strive even more fully in faith and hope to know Jesus Christ and the power of his resurrection.
From St. Paul's preaching, concluded Pope Benedict, emerges first and foremost the resurrection, without which Christian life would simply be absurd, because we are justified by Christ's death and resurrection. Following his catechesis, Pope Benedict greeted pilgrims in several languages before bestowing on them his apostolic blessing.
I am pleased to welcome all the English-speaking pilgrims and visitors present to today's audience. Upon all of you and your families, I accordingly invoke God's abundant blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.